its current state on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Today, the new fifth edition of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual for Mental Disorders, or DSM-5, as it's more commonly known, comes out. Often called the Bible of Psychiatry, the new 947-page manual outlines diagnoses for hundreds of mental disorders. Published by the American Psychiatric Association, the manual is broadly influential, affecting mental health professionals, insurance companies, the court system, and pharmaceutical and mental health research, to name just a few. It's also not without its share of controversy. The director of the National Institutes of Mental Health even came out earlier this month to say they will ignore it. Chris Hopwood is an assistant professor of psychology at Michigan State University and is conducting training workshops for the American Psychological Association on the new DSM-5. Current state producer Joe Lindstroth sat down with him to discuss the changes and the controversy surrounding the book, which is the first edition in nearly 20 years. Dr. Hopwood began by explaining the book's significant influence.
Insurance companies organize their billing codes for mental health around the DSM. Researchers, including pharmaceutical and other kinds of researchers, tend to organize their research around the DSM because it provides a common language. The DSM was originally developed in the 50s at a time when researchers and practitioners would use the same words to mean very different things. So if I said schizophrenia, it's not clear that you would know what I was talking about. And so one of the real virtues of the DSM is it provides a common language for people from very different backgrounds, social workers, psychiatrists, researchers, clinicians, patients, funding agencies, all to have the sort of common idea for what we're talking about when we're talking about mental disorder.
The book hasn't been revised since the mid-90s. What are some of the more important changes, in your view, in this new edition?
One of the big changes has to do with the way the diagnosis is actually written. In the DSM 3 and 4, which were the previous two editions, and they were largely similar, the DSM 3 having come out in 1980, the diagnosis was established along five different axes. The first axis was what we normally think of, mental health problems like depression. The second axis was things that were thought to be more enduring, like personality disorders or mental retardation. The third axis had to do with medical syndromes that might be part of the picture. The fourth axis had to do with social or other kinds of things going on in a person's environment that might impact functioning. And the last one was an overall functioning scale. So as you can tell, that's a little bit complicated.
Quite.
Right. And so what they've done is they've collapsed the first three axes so that there's basically one diagnosis. And that's actually the way it happens in the rest of medicine. And so the idea here is to bring it in line with the way it works in the rest of medicine. If you go to your oncologist or any other kind of physician, you get one diagnosis, and that's really it.
There are some changes due to specific
right.
diagnoses, like autism, for example.
That's right. Yeah, I guess I would classify those changes into a couple of different categories. One category is where they've collapsed diagnoses, and autism is a great example of that. There used to be three similar kinds of diagnoses in the DSM-4. They were autism, Asperger's disorder, which is sort of like autism, but it's less severe, and there's less in the way of language problems that are typically associated with autism, and then pervasive developmental disorder, which is kind of more sort of a wastebasket category for people who don't quite meet criteria for one of the other two. Research suggests that all three of those things are really one common dimension, and that they distinguish levels of severity on that dimension rather than different kinds of people, per se. And so they've collapsed in the DSM that diagnosis into one autism spectrum dimension. Another example where they've collapsed is that in the DSM-4 there was substance dependence and substance use, or excuse me, abuse. And so, for example, with alcohol, you could have alcohol abuse, which means that you use alcohol, maybe get in some trouble using alcohol. Dependence, on the other hand, is distinguished by tolerance and withdrawal symptoms, so the need for cravings, the need to drink, for example, in the morning. There's another example where abuse seems to be more about a less severe version of dependence rather than a different kind of disorder, per se, and so they've collapsed those two.
Is that going to change how treatment centers then diagnose whether, you know, put the threshold about whether a patient is eligible for their services?
That's right. I mean, that's one of the comments that I get from people I talk to in the substance use area, is that a lot of their triage decisions, so when they decide to triage a patient to one kind of service or another, have largely been based on the distinction between dependence and abuse. And so those systems will have to become accustomed to a new system for doing that. You know, the DSM is a big change, and people get very used to thinking along the lines of the DSM. You know, I myself was trained in the the DSM-IV, that's the way I was trained to think about psychopathology, and I think all of us are going to have to get used to some of the changes before we can really determine whether they were good ideas or bad.
Now, the DSM-5 has received quite a bit of criticism.
That's right.
The director of the National Institute for Mental Health, Thomas Insel, even came out a few weeks ago disparaging its contents and announcing that the Institute will just flat out ignore it.
Mm-hmm.
How damaging is that to the credibility of the DSM?
Well, you know, for a long time, the NIMH and the APA have sort of been in lockstep. They've really been complementary, and that's really useful because when you organize a research study around the DSM categories, that, you know that you have a decent shot at NIMH if it's a good study of getting funded. And so divorcing those two, you know, you risk losing credibility for the DSM, and maybe that's part of the point that Insel's trying to make. And just decoupling, it risks decoupling practice from research, which I think is always sort of dangerous. You know, I can see Insel's point to the extent that we know pretty certainly now that there's not such a thing as a diagnostic category per se. That is, it's not true that you can find one group of people who have a disorder and one group of people who don't. Rather, the symptoms of mental disorder are distributed in all people. Some of us get sad sometimes, some of us don't. And where you draw the line between a person with a disorder and a person without, in fact, is somewhat arbitrary, right? And there are more evidence-based ways of thinking about these kinds of problems that haven't been incorporated into the DSM. I think where I sort of disagree with Insel is that, first of all, he talks about biology and biomarkers, and the truth is we're just not there for clinical practice. So, you know, if he shows me how to use a spinal tap and a blood draw to diagnose my patients, I'd be open to hearing that. But the truth is right now we're not ready for that quite yet. And so, you know, research-wise, yeah, I think that's a good priority. In clinical practice, we're just not ready for that.
It seems absence another alternative by just taking away the DSM-5, as flawed as it may be, leaves clinicians like yourself without that common language.
That's right. That's what we really have to have.
Is it too early to see what this impact, this division will have on psychiatry and psychology?
I think so. I think in general it'll be interesting to see what the role of the DSM is moving forward.
There are other criticisms. Mm-hmm. Some have said that this was rushed, albeit 15 years in the making. There's not enough scientific data for some of these diagnoses. The APA, the American Psychiatric Association, makes money off of this book. Those are a couple highlighted ones.
That's right.
Can you speak more about those?
It's a very difficult process, right? The APA, I think, spent $25 million or so, as I recall, on this process. And, my own personal opinion is it's fair to try to recoup your money in such an investment. Now, how much you should make is a different question. I don't know. Certainly, the issue of conflict of interest is something that's important and needs to be thought of about carefully. I think, in general, you know, in terms of moving things too quickly and the scientific evidence, I agree with you. 15 years is a long time to wait for a new manual, right? And there are some changes that I think have been a long time coming that we needed to change. You know, you could always say, well, we need more information, or you could always say we need the manual to come sooner. And so I think no matter when the thing came out, probably people would be criticizing in both directions on that particular point.
There's something that seems trivial, but it's actually not. Up until this latest edition, the DSM-5, the number was a Roman numeral.
That's right.
And now they're using the number 5. What is the significance of that?
Yeah, it's actually not trivial, and it speaks to the question that you just asked me previously, which is that the idea is that it could be more responsive to research as it comes along. So if there was a major finding in some area of psychopathology that needed to be incorporated into the manual, and we didn't want to wait another 15 years to incorporate it, the idea is that 5.0 could become 5.1, so that change could be implemented more readily, and that we could have 5.1, 5.2, et cetera, before we have to get to 6.
There's more than science, it seems, that goes into the DSM. Cultural values, social norms inevitably play a role. Mm-hmm. I think homosexuality is a prime example of this. Mm-hmm. What happened with homosexuality?
Well, obviously, our culture has changed a lot around the issue of homosexuality over the last 50 years or so. And, you know, in the previous editions of the DSM, it was pathologized as a mental disorder. So you could get a diagnosis if you were homosexual. That changed with the DSM-3, and it's no longer the case. But that's a good example of where various cultural factors influence the kinds of diagnoses that get listed. A more contemporary example is internet gaming disorder, right? And so, obviously, in the 50s, that wouldn't have been a reasonable diagnosis. But nowadays, the internet's an important part of all of our lives, and people can use it pathologically. So that raises questions. If disorders are truly ultimately biological in a sort of simple world where there's either biology or not biology, the fact that culture influences diagnoses would seem to be problematic. On the other hand, Mental health doesn't work that way. You can't reduce everything to biology, nor could you ever ignore biology. And so the truth is that the DSM has to be responsive to what's happening in culture at any given time.
With this new edition, are there any new disorders?
Yeah, every edition has sort of disorders that are close to the line of making the cut, and there's a couple that made the cut this year that are new. One of them is gambling disorder, and so this is regarded as similar to any other sort of addictive disorder, one of the sort of like the substance use disorders. Another one is a disorder of childhood called disruptive mood dysregulation disorder, which involves children that are early school age, I think 6 to 10 or so, who have sort of chronic negative moods along with a lot of temper outbursts, sort of difficult to manage kids. I think this was a response in part to what many regarded as the overdiagnosis of childhood bipolar disorder in children. And so this provides maybe a different kind of category for capturing those kinds of children who we don't really know if they're going to end up being bipolar or depressed or what later in life.
Critics might argue that's just another reason to medicate more of our children.
That's exactly right. That's been the criticism. I would say if in fact this reduces the likelihood that children will be diagnosed with childhood bipolar disorder. I mean, the diagnosis of bipolar disorder typically comes with a medical treatment that's pretty severe and profound. And so it could actually change the kind of pharmaceuticals that are used for those kinds of children. Anytime you add a disorder, you may include a larger group of people who would meet criteria for disorder, and it could increase the treatments for those disorders, obviously. There's no real valid place to draw a line between disorder and non-disorder, and there's strengths and weaknesses to drawing lines at different places. So if you include more people in a diagnostic category, you risk labeling, you risk over-pathologizing, you risk over-medicating, but you include more people who are suffering for services.
Who can qualify.
Who could qualify for, exactly. On the other hand, if you make it more exclusive, then you lower the risk for stigma and over-medication, et cetera, but now you've reduced the possibility that people who might need help would be able to get it. And so, again, it's another example of where this could be a more nuanced conversation, I think, than are we over-pathologizing or under-pathologizing? And really, without the idea of values being in that conversation, we're going to get a little lost, I think.
Now, backing up, with all of these criticisms, you have the National Institute for Mental Health, the director, coming out and basically saying he's going to ignore the DSM-5.
Mm-hmm.
There are plenty of critics of psychiatry out there,
yeah,
who call it a pseudoscience.
Yeah.
Do these criticisms, does this prop up that argument, in your view?
Probably so, yeah. I guess I would say, what is inescapable about mental health practice is that there's values involved. When a patient comes to me, I have to make a decision about whether I think that this patient is having the kinds of problems that merit treatment. I have to make a decision about whether I think I would be an appropriate person to provide that kind of help. And I have to make a decision about whether I should bill for that kind of help, right? And all of those decisions, in part, are informed by values. And I think if we take disorders too concretely, if we think of depression like we think of a quirk, then we lose a lot of important information, right? And the fact is, people with the same experiences could be more or less depressed. People with the same temperaments could be more or less depressed depending on their experiences, et cetera. So the truth is, there's a lot of judgment in there. Now, does that mean that it's pseudoscientific to make those judgments? No, I would say, in fact, there's strong evidence that these things have biological correlates, that they relate to dysfunction, that they cost our society a lot of money, that it makes good sense to try to treat people with mental health conditions, that they keep the public safe, et cetera. And so I think if you sort of dichotomize into is it a real science or a non-science, you lose a lot of important information. It leads to a sort of unsophisticated conversation.
Well, it seems like we accept not perfect science in other areas, meteorology,
mm-hmm.
some
sure.
of these things where we are just making our best guess with the
That's
tools
right.
that we have. And, of course, everyone jokes about the meteorologist being wrong often. But,
sure.
but truly, how accurate are psychiatric diagnoses? Are they any less accurate than any other medical diagnosis?
Those are two very different questions, actually. And the answer to the first one, how accurate are they? Not very. And the answer to the second one, how similar are they to medical diagnoses? About the same. The truth is that no medical diagnoses are all that accurate. Some of the field trial results that came out in the American Journal of Psychiatry sort of showed that the reliability of some of the psychiatric diagnoses were pretty low. The agreements were in the 0.4s after adjusting for chance. So meaning that we'd agree with each other less than half of the time about a patient's diagnosis after you correct for
wow.
chance agreement, right? And that sounds pretty bad until you realize that's actually the standard for most medical diagnoses, which is sort of scary when you think about it. But it doesn't set psychiatry apart any relative to the other fields of medicine anyway.
How useful is the DSM for you? Do you use it?
I use it for certain things. I think it's a useful way to train practicing trainees, students, because that again provides a language that they can share with all of their colleagues. It's a useful way to communicate with people across disciplines. Ultimately, if I'm assessing a patient for psychotherapy, for example, or for some kind of consultation, I will certainly include DSM categories in the chart and diagnosis in the chart, but you have to go much beyond an assessment of the diagnostic criteria in order to provide a useful assessment of what's happening in a person's life. You have to get a sense of what their family's like, what they're coming in for, how they experience their problems, et cetera. And so it certainly falls short of what I would regard as a thorough clinical assessment. But in terms of doing what it's meant to do, which is to communicate information to colleagues and to patients, I think you could do worse.
Chris Hopwood is an MSU assistant professor of psychology and has been conducting workshops for the American Psychological Association on the fifth edition of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, or DSM-5, which is being released today. Thank you, Chris, for joining me.
Thanks a lot.
For Current State, I'm Joe Lindstroth.